CBN, although I'm working on that too. So I'm only going to mention very little about BBM, but I thought I'd talk about a work that's a little bit related to some of the other things we talk about, like decaying dark matter and so forth. And it's sort of goes from the ridiculous to the sublime. But let's just talk about the premise, you know, this cosmic pie chart that everybody has and shows, pie chart, concordance chart. You know, there's this thing, of course, dark matter and the dark energy are, you know, for astrophysics, they're almost equal. And so that begs the question as to whether one could be causing the other and vice versa, that they're just different aspects of the same thing. Of course, a lot of people have discussed this over time, and I'm not the first to talk about it. There are certain kind, like this Born infield Lagrangian that people talk about that may be ruled out. There's this Cheplin gas, which I'm really going to talk about a special case of that. Examples of a way you can have a dark matter that looks like a dark energy. There's a kind of neutrino model that does it, but it actually reinvents a quintessence, so it doesn't really satisfy models in which you have only dark matter and then somehow dark energy comes out. But I'll talk about three papers we've been working on. One is this brain world cosmology, and you could have dark matter flowing in from a higher dimension, which sounds ridiculous, but it actually works amazingly well in fitting all of the cosmological parameters. I'll talk about a model where we tried to see if we could invent a viscosity within the dark matter that actually could give a dark energy. A viscosity, you know, resists expansion, so that means it's like a negative pressure, which means it's like a dark energy. It's that simple. And you'll see how difficult that is to do, though it is possible. And then the last thing I'll talk about, there's a big controversy, and we're throwing our own version into that, as to whether or not the Friedman cosmology is even the right thing to think about. On a small scale, we have all these curvature fluctuations and density fluctuations, which we know they're small on a small scale, but actually on a small scale, so is lambda. The question is whether or not those corrections to the Friedman equation can explain the dark energy. That's a work in progress. All right, well, just as motivation, you know, there have been thousands of papers on brain world cosmology, and this is just the boilerplate about it, you know, in this M-theory heterotic limit, you have 11-dimensional supergravity. The universe looks like 2 10-dimensional brains with this bulk dimension in between them. You know all this, those 10-dimensional manifolds, and the particles are strings that are in here. And this motivated a whole slew of papers in brain world cosmology where you simplify it to 2 normal spaces plus 1 extra dimension. So you have this Randall Sundrum type cosmology. You have a metric with, you know, this curvature out in the brain that sort of holds things in, and then it's really a flat space out in the bulk. And you have a 5-dimensional energy momentum tensor, and you plug all that into the 5-dimensional Einstein equation. You get a revised Friedman equation, which looks at the beginning, just like the one we know and love, 8/3 pi g rho, you know, the usual curvature, and a cosmological constant in the 4-dimensional space-time. Then there are these 2 new terms. This one comes from the fact that you have a 5-dimensional energy momentum tensor, so you get an extra factor of rho. And this is the one I really like, and this is what got me started working in this, because it relates to BVN. This term is called the dark radiation. It's the projection of the curvature from the higher dimension down into our little 3 space. And the cute little thing is that it scales within this space is 1/8, which isn't because it's like a radiation, it's because you're dealing in a 4-dimensional space. But it can have either sign depending upon the curvature out there. And what we noticed a number of years ago, and this is the only BVN slide I'll show, but I show it because I figured I had to show one BVN slide, but this is an old one. But it just shows that if you introduce this dark radiation term which comes from the curvature in the higher dimension, that effectively changes the radiation dominated epoch. And if it comes in with a negative sign, that decreases the radiation energy density, so the universe expands slower. And of course, you can reduce the helium, which is why I always liked it when there was this controversy over helium and the error bars were much smaller. This was an older version where big error bars, but the smaller value, in which case it looked like there was a discrepancy out here, and we showed, well, we just introduced the dark radiation. This is proof that we live in a five-dimensional space. Nobody believed it. Okay, but there's more to it. I mean, this is just another picture. You can swipe off the web here, the two brains and the bulk dimension. And you can have this picture of like these little strings can actually float out there, or they can connect between the two brains and so forth. So what happens if matter can live out in this extra dimension? Now, we wrote two papers on this. One was, you know, normal matter floating here on the brain can sort of move along and spontaneously disappear into the other dimension. It's the explanation of where socks go in your dryer. But the other idea is, and Fred Hoyle would have loved this, is that, you know, as the universe is floating along, our little three brain matter can start flowing in from the extra dimension like this. That would look like a spontaneous creation of matter, which is just the way Fred Hoyle liked to think about dark energy. It gives you a, if you contrive it right, you can get a universal mass energy density increasing as the universe expands, since the flow rate can be proportional to the volume. And in fact, as I'll show in a second, you get a fixed point solution when you have matter flowing in from an extra dimension. And that thing we call the dark radiation actually ends up looking like a dark energy.
Equations, or you make certain projections?
Well, here, this kind of shows it here. It comes from the Weyl tensor. You take the five-dimensional and project it down.
Your 4D energy is not conserved, or is it?
It's conserved in the five-dimensional space. Five-dimensional space-time. You have the same T mu nu equals zero, but it's T, A, B in five dimensions. So it's the same energy constraint. All right, so same thing, take the energy term and the Einstein equation, get everything back the same, except now this dark radiation term is more general. It takes on this part of this T05 component of the Einstein equation, which is describing the flow of matter from this bulk dimension into the three space. And so you actually have to evolve it with time. But if you do evolve that, also it changes the equation of state parameter, which is what gives us our dark energy. But if you have it come in with the right sign, meaning it's inflowing, then this actually gives you a fixed point and something that looks just like dark energy. Here's an illustration of that. Here's energy densities versus scale factor. And just, well, just some parameters and model, I'll get to that. But here's the usual, you know, radiation matter evolution with scale factor, the 1/8 to the 4th and so forth. But if you look at this dark radiation term over time, it sort of builds in, and then at some point it reaches this fixed point, and lo and behold, you have a constant rho, which is like a lambda. So, yeah. Yeah, actually, that's a good question. I was just about to get that. We use the simplest kind of picture, which is probably wrong, which is a static bulk dimension.
The fixed dimension also should follow the sort of the Einstein equation in the fixed dimension.
Yeah, it should. And that's another level of complication that we wanted to avoid. So a simplest model, we just pick a static bulk that's somehow going through its evolution earlier, and now it's just sitting there, and we're expanding into it. That gives us the five-dimensional, the fifth-dimensional component of five velocity, and but because we, yeah.
But it's not, you know, it really depends on what you start out with.
This is just a toy model, but
you can get anything out of it. So to be fair, one should really, you know, solve the five-dimensional Einstein equation like this. Like in the 80s.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, there are all those five-dimensional b dot over b terms.
And it's very difficult to find a static solution. as we know.
So sorry? Yeah,
I
yeah.
You're able to find a static solution, so it's unstable, the whole situation.
Yeah, I agree. This is just a model to see if you can do it. And yeah, okay, that should be done, but okay, we didn't. We chose the simplest thing. Like, here's the picture. You know, you have a static bulk dimension, and now you have a three-dimensional space that's just doing its expansion into a static bulk dimension,
which means that the phi velocity in the bulk dimension is just the Hubble expansion into that dimension with some scale. And so that gives us our T0 phi. Okay, yeah.
Question what dark energy is, right? In the sense that you put in some energy.
Yeah, we're putting in, we're going to put some dark matter sitting out there in the bulk. This thing is going to sweep it up as it expands into the bulk, and the dark matter is going to tunnel through into
some very weakly interacting particles.
Yeah, without saying what it is. Yeah, it's even more contrived than that. I haven't gotten there yet. All right, it's just to see if you can get a model to work. So it turns out if you use just normal matter out in the brain, it doesn't work. It just collapses. But so we had to choose an equation, a state parameter, you know, so relativistic, you know, our norm, this is like W. And then this, you know, out in the bulk, the energy density scale is 1 over A to the Q.
And actually, we find out that something kind of stringy, Q equal 1, is the one that gives us a dark energy. In fact, you have to have Q less than 3. Okay. You have to have the dark matter inflowing, and then we get a fit. All right, that's just, you know, parameters for the, that's like the strength of the tunneling. That's the equation of state parameter. And then we get these two omegas now. There's the omega dark matter that we know and love sitting around in the universe today. And then there's this omega dark energy, and this comes in with a negative sign and cancels this. If this inflow ever stopped, the universe today would suddenly find out omega dark matter was over 3 and say, whoa, I was supposed to collapse a long time ago. So that's kind of a doomsday scenario, I guess. But so then we look at the constraints. Now, what you see on this plot, you know, the usual redshift magnitude relation, there are actually two plots here. This dashed line is our best fit with just this inflowing dark matter. And the red line is the standard lambda CDM. And the two are really indistinguishable. So it fits the supernova data as well as any with this particular model for what the inflow rate looks like. The CMB is a little bit interesting because you got dark matter flowing in time. So what happens is the dark matter potentials are growing faster at later times. And what happens is you get a different integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect so that the local structure is actually changing more rapidly. So what happens, that actually ends up suppressing the lowest multiples of the CMB. Everything else is equivalent fit. So obviously, these suppressed moments of the CMB are proof that there's inflowing dark matter from another dimension. And then the matter power spectrum, the baryon oscillation, everything looks the same, but you get this suppression on the larger scales, which nobody can see. So, but that's just one little idea. But the trick is then this is actually testable, at least in this little toy model. The actual local density of dark matter should be large compared to a standard lambda CDM model by a factor of 3. And so dark matter searches should be happy. They should see more of this stuff. And also there's this diminished matter power spectrum on the largest scales. So. It's just phenomenology. It's a parameter.
Combination of your parameters is such a 1 million from the
total. We have a parameter alpha that tells us the flow rate, basically the tunneling rate of matter into the brain. So it's essentially how fast stuff is flowing in that gives this dark radiation term, this E. Yeah.
it comes from, yeah, T05 and some parameters, yeah.
So is there any good reason why you can choose that?
I just choose a value that fits. I mean, well, okay, it's scaling of order unity to the Hubble flow. So if you just have some static bulk density out there, you need a right bulk density to recover the right bulk density that you have when it flows in, you know, what you want to have, and then you need the right tunneling rate to give you the right sign and magnitude of omega lambda, but it's just a fit. No, there's no argument why it should be one or the other. It just, the universe is born and stuff showed up out there and here, or maybe it flowed out and it's coming back, but it's just a toy model to see if something could work. And actually, I was surprised how well it worked, even though it's just a toy model. Now, if you thought that one was bad,
maybe you see this one. We've talked a lot here about the decaying next to lightest supersymmetric particle. And this is a premise that my late collaborator, Jim Wilson, was really, really enthusiastic about. If you have decaying dark matter, you know, that say some pressureless, non-relativistic chunk of dark matter that decays into relativistic particles, then you actually are injecting pressure, and the universe becomes out of pressure and temperature equilibrium because they're coming in at some high temperature and pressure. And generically, you get a bulk viscosity if you have decays leading the system out of pressure equilibrium. It's in Landau and Lipschitz how they describe bulk viscosity is actually exactly that example, but it's more on a interacting gas. But if you have atoms decaying in a gas and injecting radiation, it's classic how you get the bulk viscosity. Also, Weinberg wrote about this way back in 1971. So this idea is not new. But the question is, can a viscosity like that account for the dark energy? So the formalism of it, as I said, it's in Weinberg's book, but he also wrote a real nice paper about this. If you have some dissipative process, some entropy-generating thing that's going to lead to a bulk viscosity, you have to correct the energy-momentum tensor, and there's only one generally covariant form in a Friedman-Robertson-Walker type space, which is that of a bulk viscosity, which has some viscosity coefficient times H, and then terms that look like this, which happen to look just like a pressure. When you put it back in the energy-momentum tensor, you can see that the effect of a bulk viscosity is to correct the ambient pressure with some negative pressure term due to the bulk viscosity, which is just the resistance to the expansion. So if you have a large enough effective pressure in the bulk viscosity, you can have a dark energy. And there have been lots of papers around. That's exactly.
Phenomenology. I mean, you can crank up zeta as high as you can.
Yeah, I agree, and I'll show you what you have to do to make a physical model to try to get it to crank up enough, and you won't believe it any less than I do, more than I do. Okay, so this is just another paper that's actually, it's published by now, but this just contours if you can fit the supernova data in open cosmology and so forth with no lambda, but you have to somehow pick, you know, this strength of the bulk viscosity to be, yeah, a pretty large number, and then you get it to work. And there, yeah, all kinds of people have looked at that. So Jim had this idea, and we debated it for a long time, whether or not this works or not. You can decide yourself. Okay, it's this generic thing. You have here's how you calculate in molecular dynamics or anything else, a bulk viscosity. You take a system out of pressure equilibrium by expanding it. Now, in our case, we have the universe automatically doing that for us. If the universe gets, or whatever the vessel is, when they do experiments measuring bulk viscosity, they'll have a gas
In fact, one that's very close to what we're doing, they have a laser, so they get a high photon energy density in there and a very dilute baryon gas. And then they move a piston, and you see how long it takes the system to come to thermal equilibrium. And the pressure difference that's generated as the system expands is the thing that generates the bulk viscosity. And in a molecular dynamics case, you have to wait till, you know, molecules recollide and re-equilibrate. And in the time scale for that, you integrate this pressure difference, and that gives you a form of the bulk viscosity constant. In fact, Weinberg did that. Well, I'll get to that in a minute. So again, this is the idea. You have pressureless dark matter forming relativistic particles. So then suddenly you have a pressure every time there's a decay. Takes system out of pressure and temperature equilibrium. That's the basic idea, even though it's a collisionless gas, and that's where it gets messy. So Weinberg worked out, you know, by taking a linearized Boltzmann equation. Actually, he took it from somebody that worked it out back in 1930, Thomas. But this is the term you get for if you have a radiation being injected into a matter fluid and there's a pressure difference, then you get this term, looks like 1/3 dp d rho. Well, you know, if you had a pure radiation gas, this dp d rho is 1/3, so this vanishes. But if you have a mixture of matter and energy density, then dp d rho for the whole system is not exactly 1/3, and you get a net bulk velocity, which you would in cosmology because you always have a mixture of radiation and normal matter. There's a time scale for the restoring of equilibrium that comes in, which if you have some expanding universe, it ends up being the time scale for whatever is taking you out of equilibrium with this correction for this Hubble parameter in the denominator. In our case, it's just the time scale for radio for the decays of the dark matter. So as I said, you need dp d rho not equal to 1/3, but if you have not just relativistic particles, but relativistic particles in matter, then dp d rho is not equal to 1/3. So you get something left over. So that's how you get a model. And then you have to have a candidate for it. Of course, you have something decaying this much. It has to go into something you can't see. So something that, say, generates neutrinos. And then you can hide it, and because you would see it if it was making energetic photons. And here's what happens if you just take that idea of here's the bulk viscosity generated by decaying particles. How do you fit the supernova relation? What actually happens, here's this lambda CDM and a dark matter dominated. You actually get a worse fit than if you just had even just a matter dominated universe. And in retrospect, the reason for that was obvious, because you're just taking the matter and now you're getting rid of it even faster, and you're converting things into radiation. And even though the radiation generating bulk viscosity, both of these things scale away is 1/8. So in fact, instead of getting something that looks like a constant energy density, which is what you need for acceleration, you actually decreasing the energy density faster. So in fact, you have a worse fit to the supernova data. But okay, since we're contriving things anyways, how to fix this? And what we pointed out in our paper, and have now written a second paper on, that if you delay the occurrence of the decay, now, okay, this is another unlikely thing, but you know, suppose you have, and people have proposed this in the past, that, you know, you have some decaying dark matter, but let's say it has to go through some cascade, and then the last decay is the dominant one, and so that doesn't happen till later. That's sort of a simple explanation. Or you have some particles, some mass crossing with time, and so something that was stable becomes unstable at some late time.
Unreasonable.
Oh, I'm glad you said that.
You can have a reasonable model and that, it's not going to be some hand waving. It's not chip wringing gas.
Okay, well, good. Thank you for that note of encouragement. So here's what happens if you have decaying particles and you wait till late time to turn it on. You know, you get just the normal matter-dominated evolution, but suddenly, okay, you get the radiation coming in because you have this late decay, but you get that extra dissipative bulk viscosity energy, and that's what takes you up. And this, for a short period of time, you can sort of semi-flatten the energy density, and that's what gives you a briefly well, actually, it turned out the cascade that we tried doesn't fit all the dark energy. The best fit is if you just have some late decay suddenly turn it on, so you get this thing to pump up more to something that looks flat.
So it's one step.
One step. But we said nothing decays, nothing decays. You get the redshift to one. Whoa, time to decay. And start it. And then it'll look accelerating. This is an example. Actually, this actually gives a better fit to the supernova data, and it's a funny thing. It's because there's this intermediate redshift. There's a series of points that are above the standard lambda CDM, and we actually fit those because you got the dark energy being injected really late. So some reason that makes these intermediate points a little bit dimmer than they would have been. And if that data gets cleared up, then we could say, okay, well, it doesn't fit as well. But these are just picking two different times for that decay to turn on, you know, something like a redshift of 0.3 or 0.2 or something. Yeah. Oh, well, no, it's standard exponential decay, but the lifetime is infinity until some epoch, like at a redshift of 1 or 0.8 or something. And then suddenly there was this crossover or something happened that the decay starts then. You have to have that because you have to inject a bunch of stuff that makes this brief period of an almost constant energy density, and then you get acceleration.
It's less innocent than I thought.
What's that?
It's less innocent than I thought.
Yeah, it's good try. Okay, but it just shows you how difficult it is for this kind of paradigm to work. So that's the interesting thing, is maybe if it turns out that there really is a higher thing there, then we might look at it some more. And the last one, which is really controversial, and it, to my mind, started with some papers by Rocky back in 06 or 05, but in fact, that debate had been going on, I discovered, for many years before, which is, you know, we base everything on a Friedman, Robertson, Walker metric, and it's because you think of energy density as scalar, you can just average that over to a large, over some large domain, and you get big enough, you can average it out, that everything looks homogeneous and isotropic. But the controversy is, really comes down to, although you can average the density, you have to do the whole Einstein equation, which I didn't write, but when you do that, or even the whole Friedman equation, in an inhomogeneous clumpy background, even with slight curvature, you have to average over the tensors, and those things don't average to zero, and I'll show you why in a slide or two. But it's basically because it's the Hamiltonian constraint, and the tensors come in as a square. So what you get left over is an RMS deviation and something that's measuring the Ricci scalar, and it's really the extrinsic curvature, which is how fast the curvature is changing. It's like the specific energy in the curvature. Let me just review those schools of thought. There are a number of papers saying, this can do the cosmic acceleration. We plug it in. A beautiful review by Burchard that I like. And then there are some papers, like this one by Ishibashi and Walls. This absolutely cannot work, no question about it. You're wasting your time. Then there were a whole series of papers that looked at Lemaitre-Tolman-Bondi models, sort of the next simplest. It's isotropic but not homogeneous model where we're living inside a bubble. And then they show, you can fit the supernova magnitude redshift relation just fine, so we should look at it more carefully. And so what really needs to be done is some test in some real numerical model that doesn't use some perturbative scheme or averages or special spherical symmetry like the Tolman the Lemaître-Tolman Bondi models. So what we have been working on, a graduate student, Xinghai Zhao, and myself, is to evolve a large-scale simulation where we put in directly the modified Friedman dynamics, which I'll go through with you. And then also what we wanted to look was, okay, now you have modified Friedman dynamic. You also have, you know, the magnitude redshift relation. The photons have to go through all this curvature, and does that affect things? And we can do that by numerically propagating photons. That's just a weak lensing effect, but we'll get there. So let me just show you how that that modification to the Friedman equation comes from. There's a standard way in, you know, numerical relativity. We do this all the time, splitting the metric into these three-dimensional hypersurfaces, then a normal to the hypersurface, and you have to, you have some alpha, which measures the slowing of clocks from one hypersurface to the next, and then this beta, which is a shift from one surface to the next. We use an Eulerian gauge that just goes away to zero, but you know, it's a way of splitting the picture into snapshots of a three space with its own three metric moving along some time-like coordinate. It's a standard technique, but you can do it, you know, fully, generally inhomogeneous. Now, the relevant thing is you get two things. One is you get the change in the curvature. You know, the three metric is what's carrying the information of the curvature. And that momentum in the curvature is really what's, especially when beta is zero, it resides in this extrinsic curvature. So this extrinsic curvature is like the momentum conjugate of curvature. You know, it's the rate at which curvature is changing, as you can see here. And then it has its own equation, which is a real mess. It's why 3D relativity has taken decades to evolve, because this is a real nonlinear equation. If you plug in up here, you know, map in as FRW metric, K actually looks like the Hubble parameter. So that's sort of, for intuition purposes, it's like carrying information on the expansion. In fact, if you go down to this thing, which is the Hamiltonian constraint, which is like the energy, the zero-zero component of the Einstein equation, you actually get back the Friedman equation just like you would normally, and R carries this 1 over K term. You probably did that in freshman relativity. But if you have general fluctuations, then you have something more complicated. So this equation we can look at a little bit. The next trick in this, which the industry on this, is to introduce a domain average, which seems reasonable to me. You know, the scale factor is some average of a volume element with time, you know, to the 1/3, and the volume and volume averages of things, you know, just go by the, you know, the determinant of the three metric and times the volume. It's just standard things in introductory relativity. So here's that Hamiltonian constraint that gives the Friedman equation. We want to do this volume averaging. So you get a volume average of the Ricci scalar. You get this volume average of the extrinsic curvature scalar and also the tensor, and, you know, in the kind of spaces we work in, they're sort of conformally flat, so actually these relate to each other, and in fact you end up with just this RMS, not RMS, this variance of the extrinsic curvature, which is carrying this extra information that you have fluctuations in curvature that's growing, and then also this Ricci scalar, which also doesn't go away because it has a in these kind of spaces, it looks like a gradient of rho that's, well, it's going up and down, but
it could be different procedures of averaging, right? Yeah. Like what you could call A. Would it depend on the observable, like the supernova you measure the, you know, the redshift and the luminosity distance and things like that? So,
well, the way okay. For me, it's not a problem because I'm not trying to do it in nature. I'm just trying to do it in a simulation. So, you know, we're using a simulation that's really based on a conformal Newtonian gauge. So we have a gauge picked, and we just map from ADM coordinates to that gauge.
with an intermediate step or two. And so we know how to average these are coordinate averages. So it's straightforward in that sense, because those are coordinate averages. So once we've picked a gauge in which to do a simulation, then that's all straightforward. Now, let's see. Yeah, there is ambiguity of, in a way, of what is the real Hubble parameter, because actually it gets mixed up. The real, well, I think I have the next slide that shows it. You know, you have two things. This is now all those steps of transforming gauges two or three times. But let's see, looking for the equation that's actually the one I want. Well, this is like the Friedman equation term. And what happens is it's this extrinsic curvature carries both information of the change in the scale factor and the change in what the conformal factor of the curvature of the free space. And you have to separate those two out. And so that becomes a little bit ambiguous. But this is what you end up with, an effective Friedman equation to plug into a conformal Newtonian gauge. And then you find that it's the fluctuations in the, and this is now the Newtonian potential that gives you these corrections to what would have been the normal Friedman equation. Okay, so then the thing is to run some simulations. You know, Gadget is an easy code, you can download it. It's not as trivial to modify as I thought, but we've been working on that. This is, for example, if you like the growth of the curvature or the Newtonian potential as the simulation goes on, as you form structure. So don't have to do it high resolution just to test this. And then the other thing is to reevaluate the redshift luminosity relation in terms of these metric terms. But this turns out to be a small correction, and sort of people already knew that. It's the weak lensing effect, which is, this is just a slide from somebody's weak lensing web page, and you know, you see this stuff going around. But what happens is the diverging flux are really almost parallel lines coming through here. So even though it's going up and down, it really doesn't affect the redshift magnitude relation. Even though the path is longer, you don't see that in the flux. But what's interesting is that we actually, when we put these terms in, we do get something that looks like an accelerating cosmology. Now, these are just really preliminary results. But here is a calculation equation of state parameter. You get an effective energy density. Now, here's the normal energy density, which in relativistic thing, it's this relativistic enthalpy. So it has corrections for the fact that stuff is moving. But that's real small. Think of it as just average over the energy density. And then you get these terms, which are, you know, this RMS, or this variance of the extrinsic curvature and the Ricci scalar. And you also get an effective pressure term, and you can make an effective equation of state. And here's what we see coming out of a simulation with just this one is, well, it, this is a, you know, never mind what that's about, but this is an omega matter equal one initial model, and then we're just letting these extra terms kick in. And lo and behold, we get an equation of state parameter. It's approaching one at recent times. Now, I don't think it's going to fit too well, but we're getting something that looks like an accelerated cosmology from just a simple little thing like, were we doing the Friedman equation right? But it's controversial. Sorry?
How big are the bubbles?
The bubbles. Well, the simulations we've run so far actually haven't been on a real big scale. It's only like 100 megaparsecs cubed, just because we just want to get a rough idea of magnitude of fluctuations and what comes out. So yeah, our bubbles are sort of limited on 100 megaparsec type scale.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you make the bubbles small, you can make it this effect, but there are constraints of how small the bubble can be. It has to be many hundreds of megaparsecs in order to pass the observational constraints.
Okay, you're saying when we go back and reconstruct the power spectrum, it won't like.
It's not just power spectrum. There are other constraints just from the fact that if you have inhomogeneities,
yeah,
then you'll be able to see within the CMB itself the fact that you scatter off of electrons in some high density region.
Yeah, yeah.
So there are constraints coming from this.
Yeah, yeah, all of that we have to look at time. I mean, this was just really just the first calculation. Can we, you know, make these changes in the code to see if something that looks like an accelerating cosmology come out? And then we'll go back later and look at all of these constraints. Yeah, can we do the CMB and so forth? It's just, I thought the whole thing was going to go away, but there actually does look like there's a term that has some potential. And yeah, we have to do a simulation in a much bigger box. And yes, we have, actually, it turned, that previous slide, actually, we had done studies where we looked at different scales over which things are homogeneous. And of course, it goes away if you make the grid too coarse. But you know, we were resolving things down to only like five megaparsecs. And that was enough to get the dark energy.
But just to ask once more, you did normalize correctly like towards the power spectrum which you would have like towards the initial amplitude which you would
Yeah, well the initial thing is just set up in Gadget, you know, it's a set of Gaussian random fluctuations. And that's actually what was shown in the simulation there, if I understand your question. Yeah, so it's a standard inflation, you know, power spectrum for the initial set of fluctuations, and then we just evolved. In fact, all we evolved here was the dark matter, just to see what comes out.
Because as I understand, those terms, like they're not even debated so much, those terms which could give you an effective equational state, which is accelerating. But like I thought, the way I understood it, is the debate is about the magnitude.
Magnitude
is very small, usually, and that's why it's surprising to see those results.
Yeah, it's small, but, lambda's small, too. Yeah, but okay. Yeah, I agree you get the two things. One is you get this gradient of rho term, which, you know, is not too small at late times. And it's also, the changing in the potentials that gives you this extrinsic curvature term. But okay, this is just our first preliminary result. And we have to go back and check, do we have the right amplitudes here and there? But okay. Let's just summarize up here. The end, you know, it's really a challenge, as I think you could see, to account for both the dark matter and dark energy under a single premise. I mean, all three of these models, maybe the last one, not so much, seem a little contrived, and it's certainly the last one's controversial. So, surprisingly, this inflowing dark matter fits the constraints as well as the lambda CDM, but you saw how much of just a simple model it is. Obviously, it has to be done better. This bulk viscosity, I think, has like some sort of epsilon to the fourth probability. First of all, you have to believe this makes the bulk viscosity. Second of all, you have to believe that you can somehow delay the decay that produces the bulk viscosity at a late time. And actually, there's a third thing. You have to scale it up a little bit to get it to be all the dark matter. So it's at least an epsilon cube probability that it's right. And then there are these corrections to the inhomogeneous Friedmann equation. And at least in my mind, that now that we've done our simulation, this remains a possibility, although we have to keep looking at it. Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much. Just one more question on the first scenario there. Did I understand it right that the dark matter on the brain like has a different equation of state?
It has to. It doesn't work unless you do that.
There's two different sort of
dark matter. Yeah. So, well, actually, it's kind of interesting. So, because it turns out to be kind of a stringy equation of state. So maybe you can think of the dark matter as a string that's sort of attached to the two brains. And, somehow it unloops from one, and then it loops back into this one. Then it becomes a dark matter in this brain. Wow. Okay.
Three snaps.
It snaps and then recloses on the brain with the and it's just something like that. Okay.
Let's break coffee.
Yeah, coffee. Good idea.